Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is the second of two Dhamma talks on the wisdom of developing restraint. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on November 5th, 2016. This talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So the wisdom of restraint. This article cites four suttas where the Buddha teaches restraint in slightly different applications, but they all relate to using the concentration that we develop to support the refined mindfulness to recognize when contact at our senses creates a reaction and craving and then following clinging. That we're able to notice that process occurring and interrupt it. And it's at that point of contact that we are developing the refined mindfulness to actually be aware of it and not be so distracted that we can't recognize this process. In the talk that I gave Tuesday, I mentioned how the idea of restraint at the senses relates directly to dependent origination, and how from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, dukkha arises, confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. And it's because of wrong view. We don't understand who we are in relation to the world that we live in, the phenomenal world, that we're ignorant of these Four Noble Truths, that we create a reaction. If we truly understood the nature of dukkha and that craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha, we wouldn't react because we would understand the consequences of that. And that's really what you could say the whole path is about, developing the understanding of the consequences of our own actions and the thoughts and intention behind our actions, which is really what's most important to develop. There's another article on my website that somewhat relates to this called Right Intention, Emptiness of Clinging, and that article puts a little emphasis on developing the right intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. But it's all part of this idea of restraint. And I also quoted last week's talk, this, I think you probably all heard this phrase, life is a banquet, don't leave the table hungry. And that's a modern adaptation of have no restraint. The purpose of life is to grab onto everything that we can, and obviously it's really the opposite of that that brings lasting peace and happiness. We should take only what we need, and then we'll develop happiness. It points to living a very simple life in actions, but even more importantly, in the way that we think about ourselves in relation to the world. We don't need to treat our lives as a banquet table where we're supposed to be grabbing at everything. The last two suttas that I'll cite, well, the Pamadavaharad Sutta is the first one. And in this sutta, the Buddha shows the value of restraint and abandoning heedlessness in developing the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha's words, friends, pay close attention. I will teach you about one who dwells in heedlessness and one who dwells in heedfulness. And how does one dwell in heedlessness? When one is unrestrained at the eye, the mind is agitated and distracted by mental fabrications. When agitated and distracted, there is no joy and no passion for the Dhamma. Lacking passion for the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only heedlessness. When one dwells unrestrained over the ear, or the nose, or the tongue, or the body, the mind is agitated and distracted. There is no joy and there is no passion for the Dhamma. Lacking passion for the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only heedlessness. So the Buddha is first pointing out that it is contact with the five physical senses that leads one to distraction and heedlessness. And now he's getting to the sixth sense of the sixth sense base. When one dwells unrestrained of thoughts, the mind is agitated and distracted by ideological fabrications. There is no joy and no passion for the Dhamma. Lacking passion for the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only heedlessness. But the Buddha doesn't leave us there. This is how one dwells in heedfulness. And how does one dwell in heedfulness? When a Dhamma practitioner dwells in restraint with the eye, with the nose, with the ear, with the tongue, and with the body, the mind is not agitated or distracted by mental fabrications. There is joy and passion for the Dhamma. There being passion for the Dhamma, there is serenity. There is contentment. The Dhamma is present moment by moment, and they dwell in heedfulness. When one dwells well restrained of thoughts, the mind is not agitated or distracted by ideological fabrications. There is joy and passion for the Dhamma. There being passion for the Dhamma, there is serenity, there is contentment. The Dhamma is present moment by moment, and they dwell in heedfulness. So that talks to the refined mindfulness of holding in mind all eight factors of the Eightfold Path as our life unfolds, and seeing things in relation to those eight factors. The Buddha continues, this is how one dwells in heedfulness. So that's the end of that first sutta. And again, the Buddha is pointing out to use our senses in an appropriate way to recognize how they can cause reaction or how they can help us develop that refined mindfulness of simply being aware of what's occurring. And in that way, we're using the ego as a function of the mind rather than the motivating force behind our lives. We're no longer driven by our ego personality. It's simply a point of reference. And it's a point of reference through the senses that we relate in a refined, mindful way of life as life occurs. Is that clear? And is it... Yes, Judy?
It is, but is it also like... we've talked about before where every moment and when things occur, you're present enough to know that you have a choice which route to take,
yes,
in reaction to something or to not react?
Yep, and that really is the point. And we shouldn't be overly fixated on recognizing that, or that can be its own distraction, but simply have developed the concentration and the refined mindfulness to understand whatever is occurring, there's no me in it. I don't have to attach myself or define myself by what's occurring. It's simply life occurring. And it's best to not even, in a subtle way, saying it's my life that's occurring, because that's a subtle form of self-identification. It's simply what's occurring. It's not happening to me. And if you think about that understanding in its broadest sense, it's not happening to me, it's simply what's occurring, then we're really in the stream of life or the flow of life, aren't we? Because we're not reacting or resisting anything. We're simply present with life as life occurs. Without the self-referential judgment of, I don't like this, or I like this, or I want more of this, or I don't want any of this, it's simply what's going on. And so we're free of self-referential views. So this is another short sutta called the Kuma Sutta, or the Sutta about the Tortoise. And this sutta uses metaphor to show how the Dhamma is a protection against the mindlessness that arises from unrestrained desire and the peace and happiness that develops directly through restraint. And in the Kuma Sutta, the Buddha uses this metaphor to teach the importance of restraint in thought, word, and deed. The Buddha's words. Once there was a tortoise foraging for food. A jackal was also foraging nearby. The tortoise noticed the jackal and withdrew into its shell. The jackal also noticed the tortoise and went to the tortoise, hovering around and thinking, as soon as the tortoise comes out of its shell, I will eat it. The tortoise remained in its protective shell, and the jackal eventually lost interest and looked elsewhere for a meal. Just as a jackal hovers around hoping for a meal, Mara, so Mara is that malevolent god that's used throughout the Pali Canon to signify a confused and deluded quality of mind. Right? Mara is wrong thinking or wrong view expressed through our wrong thinking. Just as a jackal hovers around hoping for a meal, Mara hovers continuously hoping to create confusion, delusion, and disappointment by contact with the eye or the ear or the nose or the tongue or the body or through the intellect. On seeing form with the eye or hearing a sound with the ear or smelling an aroma with the nose, or tasting a flavor with the tongue or a tactile sensation with the body. Excuse me. If you have no restraint at these senses, unskillful qualities such as greed, aversion, or deluded thinking will arise, and suffering will follow. Guard the senses with restraint, which is really just, again, getting back to that quote, it's really the opposite way that we're usually encouraged how to live our lives. It's about acquisition and getting as much stuff as we can and having as many exciting and grandiose experiences as we can, rather than recognizing what's most important is my calm and peaceful mind and not creating identity over things. And oftentimes our mind will say, well, does that mean I'm not supposed to enjoy my life? It really means just the opposite. It means to be mindfully immersed in your life as it occurs without creating an identity, because it's in that self-referential views that we create disappointment, where there is only a meaningful life. And that meaningful life can occur no matter what's happening. A meaningful life doesn't only arise from events and occurrences that we want to happen. A meaningful life means that we're open to experiencing all of life as it occurs, without restraint. Without the right restraint. The Buddha continues, do not crave for or cling to any thought or idea or mental fabrication without restraint. And so this really gets to the heart of the matter. A self-referential ego self must instill itself or have every thought must be a self-referential thought. That's how the ego protects itself and continues itself. As we start practicing restraint, a self-referential ego self must see itself or establish itself in every thought that occurs. Another way of saying that is every thought that occurs to an unrestrained mind is a self-referential thought. We see things in relation to this ego rather than simply as what's occurring. So an example that I often use is I might be somebody who likes the color gray. So I really don't like that black pillow. I wish it was a gray one. And really, we should only have gray Zafus in here because that's what I like. It's a silly example, but I've created an identity over that like of gray, and so I don't like black. I have to have these distracting and discriminating thoughts in my mind all the time because all my thoughts are self-referential. If I'm present with what's occurring and I have no preference as to life as life occurs, all the Zafus are fine with me. I don't have to be distracted by thinking I like these and I don't like that one. And again, it's a silly example, but we do that with everything. And if you think about the infinite number of things that we attach to that way, we can really learn to recognize we become so distracted. It might be we have preferences over trees, or a good one, it would be color of skin, wouldn't it? You know, and how that has lasted. Great, what's a great example right now is political preference, isn't it? And how we're becoming more and more polarized by that. That's a pretty grand example. But we do it on very, very subtle levels, and it's mostly the subtle levels that we get caught up in. Our seemingly innocuous likes and dislikes that we don't think add up to anything add up to a self-referential life that's prone to disappointment. And it's those subtle aspects that we need to look at. And we can only look at that if we have a well-concentrated mind and the correct framework in which to see these things. Or else we won't recognize it. You know, that's the other aspect of dukkha, that dukkha itself is distracting. I know you've heard me say that the Buddha could have nearly as accurately presented the First Noble Truth instead of there is dukkha, is there is distraction because of dukkha, because of the preoccupation with dukkha. Lost the page. I'm going to go back just a little bit. If you have no restraint with regards to thoughts, ideas, or mental fabrications, unskillful qualities such as greed, aversion, or deluded thinking will arise and suffering will follow. Guard the senses with restraint. Guard your thinking with restraint. When you abide with the sixth sense base well guarded, mara, or confusion, delusion, and disappointment, and mara is another metaphor for dukkha, mara has no opportunity for further distraction and will lose interest just as the jackal lost interest with the tortoise. Like a tortoise well protected in its shell, a wise disciple, restrained, independent, harmless to all, free from ill will, is totally unbound. So the Buddha is describing how we achieve that unbound state or an awakened state. And that the idea of using the tortoise as food for the jackal, and then the metaphor of Mara needing the sustenance of our own confused and deluded thinking in order to continue, brings the point to looking at our thoughts and developing the refined mindfulness in each moment. Each moment has the potential to incline our minds towards awakening or continuing down that road of confusion, delusion, and suffering, and like the jackal waiting for the tortoise to come out of its shell. We're waiting for the big payoff, and yet we're always disappointed. And because we're caught in that cycle of wanting things that give us pleasure and ultimately finding disappointment in so many things, we start creating this subtle aspect of our lives that life is just too disappointing. Where's the meaning? Well, the meaning, we're losing the meaning because we're placing it in temporary objects and ideas that cannot satisfy this. But when we let go of those self-referential views, then life itself, as it unfolds, has its own meaning and its own purpose, its own peace. Restraint at the senses, the wisdom of restraint. And this really is contrary to what a self-referential ego self needs to survive, which is grasping after everything and establishing itself in every thought event that occurs. Is that clear? And so oftentimes when we come up against this type of teaching, practicing restraint, a lot of aversion can arise. I don't want to do it. And that's really your ego saying, I don't want to be diminished in any way. Why I always say to be very gentle with yourself is precisely because of this, because the path of developing full maturity has to do with restraint. But since our ego personality does not want to be restrained, it can often feel like a challenge inside of ourselves. In our minds and even in our bodies, we can feel it. We can have that reaction. And when that reaction starts arising, whether it's on our cushion or simply as we're developing the Eightfold Path, and we recognize the need for the restraint in the moment, but there's another battle going on saying, I don't want to restrain myself. I want this, whatever it is. That's the time to be very, very gentle with yourself. Recognize the process. And if you happen to grab for something out of a lack of restraint and you recognize it, just recognize it and don't judge yourself for grabbing, because then that creates more conditioned thinking. So this whole process of restraint is to recognize what we're doing but not judge ourselves harshly for doing it. So you can really bring each factor of the Eightfold Path into restraint. Right view implies restraint of view. We see things clearly. Right intention is practicing restraint by recognizing, abandoning, craving, and clinging. The virtuous aspects bring in restraint when we recognize that we're engaged in possibly in wrong speech. Recognize that, practice restraint, engage in right speech. And the other virtuous factors follow the same way. Right effort is greatly informed by restraint, because if we're having the unrestrained thought that I'm just too busy to even sit for meditation, restraint applies. Hold on. I have a few minutes to sit in meditation. I have a few minutes to look at the Eightfold Path and see how I can integrate that into my life. Of course, right mindfulness is an entire practice of restraint, to recognize when we're engaged and holding in mind. Mindfulness means to recognize, or to recollect, or to hold in mind. So when we recognize that we're holding in mind something that is hurtful, we practice restraint and let go of that. And ultimately what we do, this gets back to the Vitakasanthana Sutta that I taught a month or so ago, and you remember there was a line in there where the Buddha says we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. That's the greatest freedom of all. Our minds do not constantly have to be churning out self-referential views. In fact, what a common peaceful mind really is a non-self-referential consciousness or unfolding of thoughts. And those are very peaceful thoughts because they're non-self-referential. We're not engaged in anything. It's simply recognizing life as life unfolds. And of course, right meditation, practicing restraint, every time we're sitting in meditation and we find that we're caught up in our thoughts and we recognize that, come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting the self-referential ego self's need to establish itself in every thought, word, and idea, and to continue with what many of us call monkey mind. Monkey mind is simply a mind that is out of control because of that self-referential ego self. Restraint starts quieting monkey mind, starts quieting that mind. That's why concentration is so important, because concentration is a well-restrained mind. It's what we're looking for, what we're hoping to develop. And through that well-restrained mind that we develop on our cushion, we're able to express that through our thoughts, words, and deeds off our cushion. So these four suttas, and there's many more where the Buddha talks about restraint and teaches restraint, but I put these four together because I think they're most clear and most direct. Although the other ones are too, I just like these really. That's the truth. But this is the essence of the Dhamma, learning to restrain ourselves. And if you think about how I describe awakening as a full human maturity, what is immaturity? Immaturity is a lack of restraint, isn't it? We go crazy, we want everything. A fully mature, fully awakened human being is well restrained. You look at the image of a Buddha, it's always, almost always like that, showing that peace and calm that comes from restraint. But the Buddha didn't spend 45 years just sitting like that. He lived probably the most effective life any human being ever lived, but always well restrained, and that's why it was such an effective life. Remarkable, isn't it? So that's the end of the talk. Any questions before we go around the room about the talk or practicing restraint? No. Good. Jen, good to see you.
Good to see you. Meditation has been a little short lately, and I've been distracted with being busy. When I'm meditating, I still have monkey mind, but I'm not mad about it anymore.
Good.
So that's good.
It is good. Yeah.
You know, I'm just seeing it and then kind of laughing at it and then bringing back to the breath. And then one other cool thing that I started realizing this week was. Kind of the physical sensations of stress and worry, and how like where in my body I'm holding things, and sort of being able to because I'm more mindful of my physical body, because I'm bringing myself back to my breath often, kind of being able to see, feel sort of where I'm holding a worry and kind of relax it.
Yeah.
And how that actually affects what's going on up here. So it's almost like, oh, I have to think about this now, I have to think about this. You know, versus just kind of like, oh, I don't have to think about that. I don't have to think about that. You know, just think about right now and what your breath. And, you know, so that's cool.
Yeah, it is. And we really do feel these things in our bodies and in our minds. So. Good for you to recognize that. And to not judge yourself harshly. It's all over.
Whatever, you're just thinking about it again. That's fine. Now breathe.
Yeah, and when you start developing that right view, you just realize the absurdity of this. You know, it is to put yourself through that. It's just absurd. But we do it all the time.
Yeah,
it's good to laugh about it. Glad you're here, Anthony. Good to see you.
Hi, John. my restraint was tested pretty badly last week, and. I felt what Jen was describing, because my stepfather was on the brink of death, and he actually died Tuesday. And then Monday, we got a phone call. I thought it was related to my stepfather. It turned out my father had a massive heart stroke, a brain hemorrhage, and my stepmother couldn't make medical decisions. She passed it off to her daughter, and my stepsister called me, and she couldn't deal with it, and she passed it off to me. And I'm on the phone with this doctor asking me if you know, he should, you do brain surgery on my father, but it'll probably kill him, or let him die naturally. And I felt this wave of anxiety, and I was like, no, this can't be happening to me. I can't lose two fathers, you know, at one time. And so I just, the practice really came in. I mean, I just said, all right, you just have to deal with this, you know, and I just let the, like follow the feelings of my body and tried to calm down, figured out a way to get a doctor on the phone, and got on the phone with the doctor, and he was, the person who I was able to find was so incredibly understanding and helpful, and actually re-guided the doctor's decisions into making a choice that was a lot less risky, that ended up working okay. I mean, we don't know, he's still in critical condition. And so I've been spending a lot of time dealing with the notions of clinging and craving and trying to release impermanence and accepting it, and a lot of time holding the hands of people dying, which is a very magical experience if it's done right, you know, and you just go to the hospital every day, and it's like, well, you know, he knows I'm there, he's holding my hand, you know, and it's kind of remarkable. It's sad to let go of somebody, but at the same time, I sort of think that the practice has to be helping me a lot, because I'm calm about it. You know, I'm not freaking out like I thought I would be and when I've reached this point in my life. You know, I'm reflective, and sometimes I cry, but mostly I'm very accepting of it, and I think it has a lot to do with what we've been learning here, restraint and being able to deal with impermanence better than I would have been on my own without the resources. I'm thankful for this and the practice.
Thank you for sharing that. It's important for all of us to hear that. It really is how it works. The Dhamma doesn't take away human feelings. You feel them deeply, and you don't have to react to it. And you're able to stay present and be helpful. Rather than, you know, I remember when you brought me back to when my mom died. And I knew she was in the intensive care room. I knew she was dying, and I was able to hold her hand. It was awful. I can still feel how terrible I felt, but it was also joyful because I was able to be there. She had dementia for many years, so who knows what she was able to. But I felt like she was able to know that I was there. What a magical experience.
The hardest part is when you're hovering around that bed, and you just almost a little bit feel repulsed, like I can't. This isn't the person I know. I can't do this. And then, but once you release that, and you sit there and you hold their hand and you just be with them, it gets easier.
Yeah, and I bet you had this experience. Well, maybe I shouldn't say I bet. You're able to take in the whole person, that they've lived a life, and especially when it's someone that's that close to you. It's not the fact that they're dying in this moment. It's that I was able to be present for this incredible person's life. I'm gonna cry. Of course, that's how we feel about our loved ones. And when you see it clearly, you can. It's a holistic view. It's a holy view. We see everything because we're not so narrowly focused on simply the end of life. We can see the entire life because of right view.
Well, yeah, the irony is, the only reason you're experiencing so much pain is because you had so much pleasure. So if you would you want to relinquish the pleasure to not have any pain?
That's exactly the point.
Miserable life.
Yeah, if you want to have life, that's part of it, you know. But it's only one part of it, and it's really in some ways it's the least important of in an entire life. What's most important is that we're mindful of life as life occurs. And good for you. Thanks for bringing that up. Laura, it's good to see you.
Good to be here. I don't know how to follow that so much, because now I'm kind of just pondering. I need to get back into regular meditation practice for sure, because I have a sense that I'm much more distracted when I'm not meditating regularly. It's as if, like, that little piece of the path, when it's not attended to seems to kind of other parts slowly fall away. I need to get back on that ship and in the meantime, I'm holding on to the raft of the Four Noble Truths pretty tightly. it's good. I'm thinking about what Anthony said. I've lost some friends in the past year, so I feel like there's something about the impermanence of the body itself and just being like the recognition of that through the dying process, that you're able to experience some sort of grace in who the person really is and has been, and like the, you know, memory or whatnot of, or legacy or whatnot of what the person is. So death is a very, like, it's just as beautiful as birth. It's very wonderful. As strange as that sounds, but that's kind of what I've come to find in this past year with that process. So, anyhow, good to be meditating this morning for 20 minutes. Meditate tonight for 10 minutes. So, that's my goal.
I'm glad you're here, and thanks for saying it. Again, it's restraint that allows us to maintain a consistent meditation practice. We're restraining ourselves from those things that would otherwise distract us. Keith, good to see you. Thank you for the chairs you brought.
Oh, glad I could help. This is really a great lesson. I'm glad I came today to get the second half of it, because it really brought it all together. And I identify with so much of it, but the part really hit me this morning, struck me kind of funny, was as you were talking about when you notice yourself not being restrained, because you won't always be, not to judge yourself. I said, yeah, see, that's what you're doing, dummy. You're judging yourself. So I had a lot of work to do, but I'm very thankful for the lesson and for the song. So thank you.
Thank you. Mary, good to see you this morning.
It's good to be here. This is my first time on a Saturday, but I've missed a couple Tuesdays, so I really wanted to be here. And I listened to Tuesday night's talk, and it was very powerful. It was obvious that it was very powerful to everyone in the room. So at that point, I said, I'm just going to get up Saturday and get here. And it's a beautiful drive early, even though I come from about an hour and a half away. Just coming over the Frenchtown Bridge, I always tell Helen that it's like, if I wonder what heaven looks like, it's coming across the Frenchtown Bridge in the morning
mist.
Especially
this time of day.
Yeah, it's the morning mist. I've come over the bridge sometimes at like 6 in the morning, and you're fully engulfed, and it feels like heaven. So I've often kidded her that she lives in heaven. But this has been really important to me, because I think restraint for me is a key. It's not a natural skill set for me in terms of how I express myself, how I react to things. I use a lot of words, and I'm trying to translate that into being more succinct and concise in my work. Even in emails, you know, like we're so busy with so many emails. If it isn't worth making concise, maybe I don't need to send it. Like, I'm just trying to edit many things, right? So my speech, my many things in my work, things at home, even things related to food, you know, how the consumption piece came up as part of this, and moderation and taking what you need and what is for nutrition. I mean, I'm in the food business, so not to be, we're so caught up in being emotional and passionate about food, and, you know, so to disconnect from that is new, but it's all good. So I'm really excitedly restrained about this particular pursuit, because I'd love to say I'm really excited about this, but I am. And
it's okay to have passion for the Dharma.
I know. I have a lot of passion, and it brings me a lot of joy. So it's really been a very good couple of weeks in terms of my practice and the integration of my practice throughout my whole life, work, family, and everything that else is life. So it's really, really good to be here. And, Anthony, I'm very sorry for having to experience impermanence so up close and personal. It's been very, I feel for you and what you're going through, and I feel very grateful that you have the practice to help you. I know that it's helped me through lesser things. So anyway, very glad to be here. Thank you.
I'm glad you're here too. You mentioned food in the Arapahana Sutta, the Buddha talks about restraint in eating and saying that we don't eat for entertainment, we don't eat for intoxication, I always like that one, we don't eat to grow big or for beautification. We eat to maintain a healthy body so that we can develop the Dhamma. That's the most important thing, to be healthy so we can do this. So, thank you. And the other thing is that this is the article in these four suttas have been kind of, I've been developing them for a while and waiting to teach it, because you really do need the right context. If this was presented to someone Wednesday night, I gave the first class Thursday night up in Clinton, and there was about 25 or 30 folks, almost everyone except there were three students, I think, were there. Most everyone was new to all this. And everyone, it was interesting. Everyone said, I'm here because I want to deal with the stress in my life. Well, that's good, because that's what this will do. But if I presented this talk Thursday night, I think everybody would have left. Because it's just too much to, if you don't have the proper framework to place this in, it really does seem like annihilation and denial of life. But it, when you understand it in the right context, it's really the key to everything, practicing restraint. Judy, good to see you.
Good to be here.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Where and when are you in Clinton?
On Thursday nights. I'm not teaching in Lambertville anymore.
Where?
But I'm at the Wellness Center on 31 North.
At what time?
7 o'clock.
Oh, okay.
Meeting room 2.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a nice room, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My practice is back on track. It was good this week, I'm happy to say. And I really didn't have any particular insights to report, except for this morning. And Anthony, I too am, I got emotional. So I have been in a position when my stepdad decided to leave this life. And all I can tell you is, as difficult as it was, I felt it was such an honor to be in that position at the end of someone's life that you care about. So, good for you.
Yeah. Thank you, Judy.
Mm-hmm.
Mary, it's good to see you.
I'm emotional.
Yeah.
Just going to do that. You're hearing Anthony's experience, something great, It upsets me that I didn't have that experience.
I'm glad you're here this morning. It'd be good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Today's class was very impressive. It had some meaning, so I had to come here this time. You don't come twice a week. I had an experience yesterday that tested my wisdom of restraint. And that conversation with a client was very upset at how long something was taking, how much it was costing, and he was just unloading on me, even though it was actually not my direct fault. But instead of protecting my ego and standing ground and fighting with him, I just listened and said, okay, I'll talk to you next week. So I attribute that just it's impermanent. In a few hours, it should be okay.
Yeah, and that's the practical application of the Dhamma. And so it doesn't mean that we're the idea that I'm upset over something is not necessarily a reaction. Sometimes it's just an appropriate human feeling. It's when we want it to be different that we get into trouble. You know? And that's, again, being able to stay present with someone who is giving you a hard time is a perfect application of restraint. You know? So good for you. I'm glad you're here. Debbie, good to see you.
Good morning, John and everyone. Well, I'm just humbled. Mm-hmm. I'm so humbled because I feel like so still new at this practice and hearing how other people have been able to use their practice and integrate it into their lives is really awesome. Mm-hmm. And I feel like today was really helpful that Susan was helpful and talked because you know, just on an everyday level, I just feel like, you know, I'm trying to deal with work, stress, and be in the moment and just plug away and do it. But then I realized I kind of shifted that to home, like, okay, so at work I always have to do this. So when I get home, I want to have some control of my time. And so then I realized I'm having aversion and things are going on because I'm not just going with, you know, this is what's happening and maybe I don't have control. I mean, you know, it's like I so need space, that's the thing. It's like I need space, I'm in the garden, I want to water, I want to meditate. And I have lots of friends going through a lot of stuff right now and I need to be there for them and I need to it's just the idea that I don't get everything I want. That's okay. Restraint to be with what's going on and to find acceptance. And acceptance has always been a key for me to just kind of, okay, breathe into this moment, this is what's happening, and find that peace there instead of trying to find the peace in my space that I'm not getting. The irony of it. And, the other thing that someone said about speech, I just read that last night. I was reading a piece of your book, and one of the things I read is about the excess in speech, and like speech, and I never thought of excesses. And I kind of do that. Here I am again, talking. So that was an interesting thing to look at too. The kind of an aha moment for me last night when I was doing that reading, to look at that as something else to look towards restraint.
Yeah.
You know? Simplicity.
Yeah. Thank you. Blah. No, well, it's interesting to me. Well, I don't know what the right word is. I notice how many times students use right speech as their entry point into recognizing a lack of restraint and to develop restraint. And especially on that idea of idle chatter or unnecessary speech and how often we engage in that, just needing to constantly be communicating, whether it's verbally or, you know, with all the other things that we do to keep ourselves distracted. And it's all an aspect of unskillful speech.
I think for me it's also about the ego thing because in my work it's all about listening and being there for other people and helping them find their voice. So, you know, I think there's a part of me that's like, well, I want someone to listen to me, you know. Yeah. So there's that ego piece that comes in there for me, and so I have to watch that too.
Yeah. And it's great that you recognize it. Yeah. It's the important thing. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Sandra. I thought just when you started your talk this morning, you gave a little intro about your six sense gates and watching it. I thought just that was wonderful. You just sort of summed it up and got us going down the right road up my mind. And I thought that was just a wonderful, you made it sound so simple. And it just took sort of like 5 or 6 minutes of your time. But it was, I thought, very good intro. if you can remember what you said.
No, but I have it on tape.
What?
I have it on tape. I don't remember.
I thought that was very good. And you mentioned about the aversion to restraint. Well, I should maybe tell my story about how I started Tuesday with you. I had read the article before Tuesday's class, and I got to Tuesday's class and happened to have a few minutes with John, and I said, I don't like the sound of this. Because he was talking about restraint, and I said, I don't think I want to go there. No, I actually said that to you before I'd even given the talk. I said, this isn't going to be for me.
What did I tell you?
Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. I said, practice a little restraint.
Yeah, you did. So I had aversion to it from the get-go. But now I've got it more into and more into the Dharma. And actually, the Dharma is all about restraint when you really look at it. Mm-hmm. We could call it, you know, the restraint practice almost.
Yep.
And I hadn't thought about it that way. I just thought about, you know, do without this, do without that, do without the other. So I've got more of a rounded idea of what restraint is regarding the Dharma.
Yeah, good.
So I started off a bit apprehensive, but I can see a lot of the wisdom in it. I do have a difficulty generally. I do have a difficulty actually pinpointing the teachings of the Dharma in my life. Like, we know the Buddha went around the bowl and three robes. You know, well, I've got a lot more going on than that. I don't know, where do you draw the line? Where is excess? And where is the minimum amount? And everybody's view of each life is, you know, I'll have it going this way, somebody else will have it. So that's kind of like always woolly to me, you know, that where is excess and where is the right amount of a lot of the teaching. But, and I think this is just another one of them, right? You just have to feel your own way and just be honest with yourself and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the entire Eightfold Path develops that. It's not something that you don't have to draw a line in the sand, like saying, well, this is too much and this is too little. As you deepen your concentration, you're developing the innate ability to make the decisions about what you need because you're no longer distracted. You're more well concentrated. And the Eightfold Path itself is a practical framework for picking and choosing what's most important in your life. And as you I've never met anyone, and certainly from my experience, as the more that the Eightfold Path has developed, the simpler life becomes. But it doesn't mean that you're going to go live in a cave. Most people won't. You know, I'm not headed that way. But my life is a lot simpler than it used to be. And I think that's true for just about every one of us that begins to develop this. We just don't attach ourselves to so many things. Well, Diane, good to see you this morning. Thank you for your taxi service yesterday.
Thank you for being here and having these classes. I really, it's changed my life. I had a lot of thoughts. One of the thoughts is about 16 years ago, I started going organic. And most of what I eat is 90% organic. And when I was in bed this morning, I was in my body. And I was just like going through from my toes all the way up, and I just felt like it was cleaner and clearer than I'd ever known it. And I'm an old person, and it was just, and I was so relaxed, and it was just a pleasure to kind of travel through my body. And then I thought, wow, my whole life, I don't think I ever really knew what relaxed meant or felt like or that I had experienced relaxed. And it was just, I thought, maybe I'll just stay here and not go to the meditation this morning because it just felt so good. But I'd gone to bed about 8:30 or 9 last night, so I thought, yeah, well, okay. Anyway, and then I got up and went outside and did my exercise thing, and I really haven't heard that many birds for a while. I don't know why, but this morning I heard the wren while I was out there. And the wren came the day after my daughter passed away and has been with me throughout my whole life at really poignant and special moments. And when my experience with someone passing, after I kind of get over the initial what is kind of selfishness of the hurt, is that it changes my life. When a person's alive, they change my life, and when they die, in their death, there's a changing, because a part of me dies and a part of me rebirths. And it's not, I mean, when I was going through the experience, it was, I felt numb. And it was more of a superficial, top of my head kind of experience. But it was the day-to-day staying with myself. And I think that's what one of the things that John has taught that in this meta. I must do it with me first. I must. Because then I have nothing to give, you know, to put in to the other. And sometimes sitting. I have a classic sit that I had this week. I must have stood up, walked around my cushion and thing 5 times during the 20-minute sit. I got up and thought, this is ridiculous. There's no sense to this whatsoever. Why am I doing this? And I sit back down, Diane. And I sat back down. And I did that, something similar to that, 5 times. And I kept getting back down. And I thought, finally, about 16 or 18 minutes, little timer thing, into it, I thought, okay, I give up. And I just got up from it. And then I thought, oh, I'm choosing. I'm choosing this. And I don't think it ever was quite so clear to me, the choices, that, you know, in the minute that I have to choose to stop my mind, to stop. And it was just, I'm really glad I had that experience. It was absolutely hell when I was going through it, but I kept looking back at it all week, and it kept making me make the choice to sit on the cushion, because it told me that I'm in charge of something. I can, you know, I can actually be in charge of my mind. And then the other thing is the song of getting up and coming to the meetings that John is so diligent, so lovingly present for us, because of, well, I don't know what the becauses are, but it's a choice that I'm beginning to make for me first, that of all the things that I can choose to do in a day, taking care of me first, being with like-minded people who are wanting to, you know, mature and be loving. I'm talking too much, but anyway, it becomes a choice. I'd rather do this than go grocery shopping or go shopping or go do something that I think, with being with someone who isn't an uplifting person, I'd rather be somewhere where I'm uplifted. It, you know, it might be selfish, but I'm taking care of me first, and that, to me, that's part of the meta. Okay, that's it.
Thank you. What a remarkable class. I mean, really. the level of the application of the Dhamma is really remarkable. You know, we've talked, just this morning, we've talked about just about everything that occurs in a human life, from things that are wonderful to terrible tragedies that hurt us deeply. And we understand that this is part of life, that's all, without reacting. And we're able to appreciate all of those things, the so-called good and the bad. It's part of having a human life. And that's the real remarkable thing, that we have, when we develop right view, then we have the ability to just live our lives the way they're meant to be lived. They don't have to be any different. We can have terrible tragedies in our life and yet still be present for them and be helpful. And we can experience great joys without having them define us. It's what's occurring right now. Ultimately, we get to live in the reality of our own lives. And isn't that great? Instead of some fantasy of how we'd like it to be. So, thank you all for a wonderful class. I'll do that again after Metta. A few announcements. The Donna Dinner's coming up, November 22nd, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. There's a flyer out there. There's also some more information on the website, and if you'd like to volunteer, I think we have five or six folks, but if you want to help us set up or clean up, you can let Maura know. She's coordinating that, and there's a list of some practical gifts. And we're taking a donation. This year, the donation is going directly to Julie Klein, who owns Love and Oven, just to support her. She's never asked for a penny, and she hasn't yet. But she puts in a great effort and some expense. So whatever money we collect this year for our Donna project is going to go right to Julie. There's a basket outside for that. December 4th on a Sunday is our next one-day retreat. The theme is taking refuge in the Sangha, in our wonderful Sangha. It starts at 10, we'll end around 3. Just a relaxed day. We'll probably be two meditation periods and two brief teachings, maybe three, depends on how long-winded I feel that day. And Matt's going to join us and lead us in Qigong and bring a dish to share for lunchtime. The following week, on December 6th, we're going to start the next 10-week, probably end up going to be 12 weeks, but the Truth of Happiness course as a Sangha. We did it last year, and it really brought the Sangha together and gave us a strong foundation for what's developed this past year. So that'll start on the 6th. And the same as last year, the Tuesday and the Saturday class each week will be the same class. So if you miss one, you can make it up and keep going with that. So I think that's all the announcements. We'll finish with Metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And again, gently close your eyes. Gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And in Metta, the first object of our meditation is always ourselves. And generating feelings of deep love and compassion for the object of our meditation. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. And may I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. And now bring to mind those that you care deeply for, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind those you may be in conflict with, difficult relationships, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. Now, keep in mind, those of us, those here this morning and the other members of our Sangha, excuse me, and extend your awareness outside of this room, across our community, across our planet, across all creation, to include all sentient beings, and generating those same feelings of deep love and compassion for all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. This concludes our Dhamma practice for this morning. Thank you all for being here. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.